We'll go ahead and start with introductions. I'm Mike Odrin with Olson Engineering.
Greg Schaeffer, Development Engineering Division Manager.
Rosie Shaw, Public Works Developer Engineering.
Don Hardy, Bridger Avians.
Steve Bacon, Regional Wastewater.
Gaither Homes.
Jamie Housley, Jordan Ravens.
Jeff Erskine, Boss Ruston.
David Jordan, Concurrency.
Matt Herman, Community Planning.
Laura Lebowski, Community Planning.
Steve Tobey, Public Works Transportation.
Jeff Swanson, Economic Development.
Brent Davis, Environmental Services.
Great. Just a reminder that the meeting will be audio or be recorded and posted to the county's website on the grid, so watch your language. Very quickly, if you have cell phones, please put them on vibrate or off so they don't interrupt us. Next on the agenda will be to review and adopt the minutes. I assume everybody has read this thoroughly, and I will entertain a motion.
I move to accept the minutes.
Second. Moved and seconded. All approved. Everyone who approves?
Aye.
Aye.
That is, oh, and I. That's everyone. The review of upcoming events, Greg?
Okay, very quickly. Looks like we have a busy month of June. On the board hearings, we have three hearings on Tuesday, June the 10th, beginning at 10 a.m. First being Kingsway Christian School bond issuance, second 2014 summer supplemental, and the third is the Parks Advisory Board code amendments. Following on June 11th, also 10 a.m., is a BOCC work session, the state's health care reform plans for Medicaid integration. The week following on June 18th, 9:30 a.m., is another work session, growth allocation, request for suspension of 2015 annual reviews and dockets. And then lastly, the board hearing on suspension of annual reviews held Tuesday, June 24th, 10 a.m. For Planning Commission work sessions and hearings, there is a Planning Commission work session on Thursday, June 5th, 5:30 p.m., Comp Plan, Principles and Values and Planning Assumptions. There's a Planning Commission work session on concurrency, Lori, thank you, Thursday, June 19th, also in the evening, 5:30 p.m. And then lastly, a Planning Commission hearing, Comp Plan, Principles and Values and Planning Assumptions, Thursday, June 19th, also in the evening, 6:30 p.m.
I'm curious about, thank you, the two bottom items under the board's sessions and hearings. Jamie, what do you know anything about that?
No, I'm actually just puzzling, wondering the same thing. It's what he's planning would be great at.
Is there anybody from planning who knows what is going on there with the suspension of the annual reviews?
Typically, Laura Lebowski, Community Planning. Typically, when we are in our process of updating the comp plan, we suspend annual reviews and dockets because you don't want to have that going on at the same time as you're doing the comp plan update because that can involve rezones and that sort of thing.
So that will just be for 2015 and 2016, or will be?
It would be 2015 and 2016. Yeah.
So that wouldn't affect anything that's in process now?
No.
Okay, very good.
That's still kind of a good deal. If you had a project that's
but you can make a site specific request and then you just don't pay the fee like you normally do.
So you still go through the process, you can still get a rezone?
Yeah,
you still go through annual review.
Well, you're saying you go through the GMA process.
You go through the GMA process.
You go through the GMA process.
Right.
Okay.
And you don't pay, it's cheaper.
Okay.
Well, you don't pay the county.
Pardon?
You don't pay the county.
You don't pay the county. Well, you don't pay the consultant.
It can be cheaper, but it can be longer, and you can also be tied up in the appeals and problems with GMA.
So everything gets lumped together.
Well, in theory, though, site-specific requests would have to be appealed specifically.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
What else? What?
Appealed specifically.
There has to be a specific appeal to a specific comp plan request. is what that sounds like, right?
Yeah.
The 2007 comp plan, for example, there were some sites, for example, around the center where they see designated
yeah.
and they were tied up.
I see. Okay. But that didn't affect anything else. That was part of the process.
Right.
Okay.
There were some others that were tied up, but I don't know if you were in one of those other places you weren't.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that clarification. Much appreciated. I'll let the record show that Mr. Galimo and Mr. Wallen have arrived. Any deep correspondences? Seeing none, I don't believe any were included in our packet. Any deep member announcements?
Yeah. Mike, I want to try to get an item on that agenda. I've been having conversations with Marty in regards to potential delay of impact fees for residential as a way to sort of equal the playing field for the fee holiday that the commercial industrial uses have gotten. We found an example of some code up in the Puget Sound area. I think Pierce County is one. Some cities in Snohomish County as well that are good examples of that, so I'd like to put that on the agenda next month.
Okay.
So who would lead that?
I think Marty and I can lead that.
What?
Okay. Okay. Welcome, Marty. We started without you. Hope you don't mind.
How am I being volunteered?
Impact fee delays.
Oh, yeah.
And
great.
Pierce County.
And is that... So this is for residential only. Is there something in place right now for commercial delay?
They're waived.
Yeah. Well, they're waived, but all of them aren't automatically waived. You have to apply and you have to be approved for that. But are we assuming that all of them are being waived right now and therefore that's a non-issue?
It's not an issue.
Okay.
And this one specifically, we don't want to touch the school issue.
Okay.
So that would still be paid at normal issuance rather than when you get the final occupancy.
And is that what the request is for occupancy?
Yeah.
Payment and occupancy? Okay.
Final inspection. You don't want people to occupy and tell them you have to get out because you're not there.
Right.
So it's the time of final inspection.
Very good. Okay.
One other update from a work group. We have a work group for final planning.
Yes.
And Mr. Richmond volunteered over here to help with that committee as well. And we've got some data now, I think, on how the process is going and some additional suggestions. So we might want to touch base and have that group meet again. And we'll do that by email correspondence, but I just want to kind of update the group.
Okay. We actually have that on our...
We
have that on our agenda today.
Okay.
So we can discuss it.
Well, that's final site plan. Oh, final plan.
Yep.
Okay, so we'll start there. Perfect.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else from any of the other D members? Very good. Okay, I see that Oliver is not here.
Right,
yeah. Oliver's here. Perfect timing. Yay. Hey, guess what? You're up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What a good timing.
You want to talk about service planning, Oliver?
I will sit next to you, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting me to come to your meeting, and I will try as much as I can to be brief, give you opportunity to ask questions. For some of you that do attend the planning commission, but the board work sessions and hearings, this may be very familiar with you, or may be boring, so I'll do my best to just bring you up to date as to key decisions that the commissioners have made, and how staff, when I say staff, I mean the county and the cities are going to be working to utilize the decisions to move forward. And then I'll just leave some time for questions and answers. And then some of you may have seen this before. This is a very condensed timeline, if you will, or scope of work for the planning update. The areas that we've checked off are things that we have completed and things that are still in progress, and the timeline for completion, I'm sorry, is too dark to read. But we started, we had the kickoff July 2013, and the first thing we did was to go through a GMA overview with the commissioners. We went through really dialoguing and bringing them up to speed on the vacant buildable lands model inventory tool that we use so that we can familiarize them with that. We shared with them the preliminary scoping timeline and also presented them with the public participation program for the plan update. Those that they've all approved. Since January 2014, we have prepared a checklist. It's a draft. We are going to modify that by the time we complete the review. If there are changes to the policies of our development regulations, we are going to revise that checklist so that the purpose of the checklist is to make sure that we are in compliance with all the recent changes to the statute. So we are required to prepare the checklist and submit it to the Department of Commerce. That we have a draft, and if, you know, if you want to see it, you're welcome, but it's not complete yet. We also dialogue with the board on the 20-year population forecast that came out from the Office of Financial Management. We have been, since that effort, been working internally, community planning staff, to look at our current plan policies and streamline it, if you will. Really shorten it, make it simple, easier to read, focus on what is policy, what is strategy, and you know, really streamline that, very similar to what was done with Title 40. Since then, we've also had had conversation with the board on the job forecast that we have to use for the 2016 update. We've engaged in some conversation with them on planning assumptions, which I know some of you have interest in. We've reviewed the buildable lands model again with them, and I think we came to this group. Bob Poole made a presentation to you on the model itself, how it works, and what issues may be of importance to you. So that is our condensed scheduled. The plan again is supposed to be completed and adopted by the board and sent to the state. Our deadline is June 30th, 2016. So these next slides are the decisions that the board have made to date. Some of you participated in that process. The board on January of this year made a decision after their hearing that we should use the OFM mid-range population for the 2016 plan update. So this will be the population that the county will be planning for. This is going to be the control total for the entire county by 2035. This again is the OFM median number, and the growth rate is 1.1 going forward. The 2007, the growth rate was 2.2 for the first 6 years, and 2% thereafter. That have not happened. And you know, since the OFM projection that came out in 2005, they modified that in 2012 and released the new OFM numbers, and not only for Clark County, but for the entire state, they projected that the state would be going much, much slower than we did in the past, and that trickled down to all the 39 counties in the state. So that's the decision the board made in January. On April of this year, the board reviewed the employment projection that came out of the State Employment Department, Scott Bailey, his projections, and the county commissioners, along with the cities, reviewed those projections. This is the highest growth rate, employment aggressive job number, based on the four scenarios that Scott Bailey presented. This is for in the next 20 years, anticipation that we will see about 91,200. This is wrong by 100, so it should be 91,200. Okay, that's the total number that we are going to be planning for from 2015 to 2035. That's the planning period. This decision was made by the board on April 1st. We've had two work sessions with the board, and I will go through the changes that they've recommended we make on the planning assumptions, which we are going to be using in deciding and determining the type of growth we see in the next 20 years. So here are the planning assumptions. This will be the 2016 planning assumptions. You can see that we put all the planning assumptions on the left column compared to how they were used in 2004-2007 plan update and how they will be used in the 2016 update. You can see the OFM range from low to the lowest range to the highest range. The board again chose the mid range, which is the 562,207. So that will be the next 20-year planning population projection that we're going to be using for the plan update. What this means is that if this is the end point, the 2035, we are going to look at the growth. What is the growth between 2015 to 2035? That will be the difference that we'll be planning for. Okay, so when you see the 562, that's the total. So we're going to start from 2015 to 2035, giving us the 20-year planning horizon.
Honor, one quick question. What's our current population?
It's 435,500. That's as of April 1.
Okay, so when they were looking at 94, that would have been to this year, right?
Yes.
So we have a higher population of what was originally projected.
That, yes, that's true. And OFM in the past have been off in terms of predicting not only Clark County but other counties.
Okay.
You know, this were happening in the 70s and 80s. You know, the county was growing much faster than OFM projected. We were seeing more than 4% growth rate. In the 80s and 90s. Now we are below to the last, at least in the last 7 years or the last 5 years, we barely met 1%. So, but you know, that, those are just the facts that are out there. The planned population growth are the difference between the base and the end year. That's how to look at that second column. The another area that have been an issue, particularly those that are in the rural area, is the urban and rural population growth split. In 94, it was very close to nearly 20. This is a policy call. The board made that change in 2004 to 90-10, and they maintained that in 07, and they're maintaining that rate, that split in 2016 going forward. If you ask me what is the current urban and rural split, you can look at it in terms of housing unit, can also look at it in terms of the number of folks that live in the rural area compared to those that are in the urban area. It's about 87-14 or 87-13, depending on how you look at it. So it's much closer to the 90-10. Okay? The assumed population growth rate is shown there. As I said, if you look at the 94, we were growing faster than the 2.3 that was assumed in the 94. In some cases, we're seeing a little bit over 4% annually in Clark County, but that has changed. In the 04, the assumed population growth rate was 1.69, and if you all recall, that was appealed on the premise that that had not been a historical growth rate, which was what prompted the then board to reopen the plan again in 07 and made those assumptions that are there, 2.2 in the first 6 years and 2% thereafter. Even the highest OFM projection going forward is not up to 2%, it's like 1.9, you know, 1.7. If you look at it, you can see that it's even below the 2%. So this is part of, you know, the aging of the population, if you will, and the changes in the demographic, you know. So we met with OFM staff to make sure that they're not off again in terms of their projection for Clark County. I'll be meeting with them again in the coming weeks to see whether they can make any changes to their forecast, but I doubt it. This is not peculiar to Clark County. All the 39 counties and other counties planning under the Growth Management Act, their own population projections are much lower than what they did in the past. And OFM have indicated the reasons why that is the case. It's not so much about the recession that we are experiencing. They're looking at the makeup of our population. They're looking at the cohorts. They're looking at, you know, kids that are graduating out of college with huge debt, and recognizing that family formation is going to be much, much slower going forward. They looked at a variety of factors to come up with their latest projection. And, you know, if you look at the demographic of Clark County, about, I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but the number of county residents 60 plus is much higher than the national average. So, but they're projecting that in the coming years we will be having our population will be aging more than we have in new births going forward. You know, it may or may not be true, but that's what that's how you read their forecast going forward.
Just clarification, please, Omar. Yes. Let's take the 2016 column, please. The OFM range is 459,000 is some change to 681,000.
Yes.
How does that relate to the 1.12% assumed population growth rate? Is there a relationship?
There is. This number is like 0. I may have to get this, maybe come back or maybe share that with Craig or Rosie. I think, just off my head, I think the 45.9 is like 0.78, I should say.
Yeah.
The medium is 1.1.
Yeah.
And the highest is like 1.8. That, and again, below 2%. And I must say, you know, for the little that I know, any community, and I've said this before, any community that is growing more than 2% in terms of their annual growth rate is doing very well.
So, just to follow up on that, if I could. So the 1.12 is the mid-range, approximately,
yes,
of the OFM range.
It is the mid-range, and that's the one that
you're correcting.
And, you know, Jamie can correct me if I'm wrong, OFM have been really good at their forecast lately, if you will. Since 2010, they've been on the mark, if you will. If they've tracked very well through the census, you know, that is not to say that they weren't off in the past, but since 2010, they've come very close to the census, yes.
You mentioned before that previously they like, grossly underestimated the rate. So when we go to the next comp plan, are we getting catch up for what they grossly underestimated before, or are we just looking at new land at the 1.12, or do we look at new at 1.12 and the past population? Do we still serve that population? Or just because the 1.69 was off? Well, is that a lost opportunity, or do we look at the population number there?
I don't look at it that way. What I would look at it by saying that the growth that occurred from say 94 to the present is here, the 400 and something. That's how you look at it. The growth has already occurred. So going forward, you'll be growing or adding population at a much lower rate than you did in the past. That's how you look at it.
So you get this shortage of housing if they might be accounted for, but they might be priced out of housing because there hasn't been enough of it and it's driven the prices up and there's not opportunities for them to have homes. So maybe more people are living in smaller areas or, in a single household. So when you look at the growth plan, are you trying to find housing opportunities for that OFM range at the top? Or are we looking at just that 1.12 for new stuff? We're only looking at new?
We are going to be looking at this is the number that we're going to be looking at. And if you compare this number to this, or to this, or to this, this was, if you will, this was based on these numbers that the board chose. Mm-hmm. So this is where you're going to be focusing on. So what this mid-range implies is that the difference from our base to this number is this. So this is the new target that we have to be planning for. And this is where you do your 90-10 split. And the difference of that will be what you go to the urban area and what goes to the rural area. So this is where you're going to be focusing in terms of the number of housing units and folk that will be coming into it. This will be new. So this is what you're going to be focusing on.
And Oliver, on that, just as a segue to that, the buildable lands analysis you guys have done, are there some general assumptions? I know we're going to the Board of Commissioners on June 18th, but on the allocation of that, is there some analysis that's been done? I think that kind of fits into that question about where will that population end up going,
yes,
or where is it presumed to go,
right?
Is that sized accordingly?
Yes, I'm going to get next. So, but I just want to share with you the assumptions that the board have reviewed and what they've directed staff to do going forward. They still are maintaining the housing ratio. Again, in 94, the ratio was too high, but that's what the then board approved. 60-40 single family and 40% multi-family. Since 2004, the split was changed to 75-25, then maintaining that ratio going forward. This is an area where the issue you're raising, Eric, may also be viewed because, again, persons per household, so this is where you look at, what is the composition of any housing unit. So, again, in 94, the assumption was 2.3. That remained the same, pretty much haven't changed significantly. The census, we assumed 2.69 in 04. We moved after the 2010 census, it moved to much lower than 2.5, 2.69. And we are now a little bit up to 2.66. This is also confirmed by the American survey information and census. Again, this is another phenomenon that is occurring because, you might say, what? Why are we moving to 2.66? Children are moving back home, people are doubling up, and this is a reflection of that. That's really what we are seeing on the ground.
So, Oliver, based on historical data here, excuse me, how close are we to the 75-25 split? Up from 04, we got 10 years worth of data to track. How close did we come to that?
I think, to be honest with you, we are off.
Why did we select those numbers then if we're off?
The only city I can say, you know, this is something that the cities and the counties came together and agreed on. They recognized that the 60-40 was too high. The cities came to the county and said, you know, we need to revisit this and make some changes to it. They are moving closer to this split, but not all the cities are very close. The city of Vancouver is very close to 75-25.
What's the county average?
The county average is like maybe close to 80. In some areas it's 80. In some areas it's 100% single family. If you go to Richfield, for example, and I've said this in my own presentation to the commissioners that I don't anticipate this is something you leave up to each jurisdiction. The counties, even though this is agreed between the county and the smaller cities, you leave it up to them, like in Kamloops. It's up to them to decide how they meet this ratio. On the multi-family side, they can reach that. We're not dictating to them what they build. It could be condominiums, it could be townhouses, it could be duplexes, it could be triplexes. It's their choice. But this is a goal. We are in Richfield, you see 100% single family. That's what you're going to see in the place like Richfield. In Le Centre, it's like 95% to 5% multi-family. You look at Washougal, it is coming closer to the 75-25, but you're also looking at historically what have developed in Washougal, for example. They've built some multi-family in Washougal, and in Battleground, they're coming very close to this split. Kamloops is coming close. Again, you're looking at this is 20 years, but some communities, we're not even close. And this is where the issue of Section 215, which Jimmy's very familiar with, which says that you have to look at how well the planning assumptions that you use to build a plan, how well you're doing. If you're not coming close to those planning assumptions, you have to come up with some reasonable measures short of expanding the boundary. They didn't define what reasonable measures mean, but what they said is, if you're not coming close to the assumption that were the basis for your development of or sizing of your UGA, you have to come up with some other reasonable measures or some other action short of expanding the boundary. To me, I can read it different way. Jamie may correct me. He might say increase density. He might say do something else short of moving the boundary, but that's Section 215 for you. So let me move quickly, okay? The board, as I indicated, chose the 91,200 for the new job we have to plan or use in our planning process. They've moved away from measuring new job to housing. They moved away from job to population ratio. This was my suggestion. They're moving to jobs to housing. And the reason for this recommendation, this is how this is done in most of our neighboring or other counties planning on the GMA. When you do with population to jobs to population ratio, it is very misleading because you know that you can never get this, you know, this is not how you measure it. People will challenge us if we measure it this way. You have newborns, you have retirees, you cannot make jobs to population ratio to measure it that way. So you do it by household. It could be you and your wife, or I and my wife, both of us are working. However you want to measure it, that's the best way to measure it. On the infrastructure, so the ratio, if you look at this, you know, we've been doing it this way, and now we are going to be measuring the jobs to household. And if you look at the ratio, it's mainly, this is misleading. It is ratio of 1-to-1. That's how to read this. It's not 1-to-10. So it's 1-to-1. Okay. Another area that I believe DIB have asked us to take a look at is the infrastructure deduction due to the new stormwater rate. I must assure you, and this is true, this infrastructure deduction here only applies to residential. We have two types of infrastructure deduction. One applies to residential, is 27.7, actually 27.5. We have another infrastructure deduction for commercial and industrial, and it's 25%. So when you combine the two, it's a little bit over 50%. So bear that in mind.
And I know that Dave has commented on that number as being low in the past.
Yes. But remember, this only applies to residential. We have commercial and industrial.
We would base that on residential.
Yeah, this is,
it's way up more around 30, if not average.
You know, but, you know, there have been some studies and things that came up recently that was submitted into the record for other cities, on environmental services and our GIS, and it's even below. But again, that's because the new rent have not kicked in. You know, so I have no basis. This is all evidence based, you know, type of information. Would this change in the future? I think as things happen, it will change in the future.
We commented before about changing it, like the 27.7 is appropriate in certain soil types,
yes.
And in other soil types it's not appropriate at all. Yes. And we have some decent information already in GIS. We have the ASC classifications that we used for assumed infiltration or likely infiltration rates. We took a higher rate, applied it to the different color codings on there, and we came up with a pretty good estimation. Something that would be more reasonable.
Unfortunately, I think that should have sailed.
Has it really?
Well, these are the assumptions that the board has already accepted.
Right, yeah, and they're going to be doing this. I want to give them the opportunity and any other, the public, the opportunity to come to the hearing and also vote. They can still change it at the hearing, but they've affirmed this at the work session. I want them to affirm it in the public hearing so that they can take input from this.
That may be something we want to take up as a board or individually. We can talk about that either. We're probably not going to have time today.
Let me run this quickly.
Absolutely.
The other thing that the board have said they're going to keep, but we recognize that this may change. Jimmy, you were at the work session. They're still having some issues. Our assessors, you know that the assessment lags, but these values may change, but for the time being, the board is saying keep it. We are defining what is vacant as for residential, if the value is 13,000 or less. For commercial and industrial, we're saying it has to be at least 67,500. This is an area that GIS and assessors are still working on, and we'll have the opportunity to hopefully recommend changes in the future. But for the time being, they believe that our data is as good as it can be. Okay? The board has asked that if you look over here on market factor, this is where you add additional land in terms of the sizing of the UGA. For residential, it was 25% in 94, 50% for commercial and industrial. That changed in 04 and in 07. The board is saying we maintain 10% additional land added if need be, and change to zero. Market factor that was the case in 07 to now 10% for commercial and industrial. So that's where the dimension change. I want them to affirm this. And it is a plus, you know, if you will. I want them to affirm that in the hearing. Okay? So here's what's next. We have a work session with the commissioners June 18. The focus of that is going to be on growth allocation. I have been meeting with the cities. We have to agree on how we divide up the population and the new jobs decisions that the board have already made. So I'm having a meeting with the cities to agree on that, and that agreement is what we're going to be presenting to the board. We have a hearing on the 24th. The board will have to take testimony on the growth allocation, all the other planning assumptions, principles and values. And we also asking for, or will be asking for, suspension of the 2015 annual review documents. You guys will agree with me that it makes no sense to be taking and doing the annual reviews quickly through an annual cycle. That is, you will have the opportunity to still submit requests.
We talk about that in the meeting. Don't end the meeting today. So
okay. Yeah. Okay. So.
Albert, just a clarification. 2016, though, if you want to do an annual review, you can do it in 2016.
You can do it in 2016 because you have only 6 months left.
plan, so we will not have opportunity to do it. So it probably will be 2017.
Okay. I guess the one question, the industrial land bank issues, I'm assuming that gets rolled into the comp plan?
No, the industrial land bank you can do out of cycle. And we still have the sunset that says you have to complete it in 2016, which I think the governor signed. So the deadline for industrial land bank is December 2016. So, but you can go out of cycle. It's my goal that, you know, we'll get someone on board who can start working on that so we can complete it. That takes me quickly to the BC. This is FYI to you. We're having a work session with the BC today. The focus will be on massage parlor ordinance. This is came out of a complaint driven, and it's not a, really a land use issue, but we drafted a code that the board will be doing. It will not impact existing licensed massage parlor be going forward. The concurrency is on there tonight. Then I'll be again discussing with the planning commission the principles and values that the board have reviewed and approved, and this the planning assumptions as well. Then I will be discussing with the planning commission the road allocation and what I'm calling issue paper 4. All this information now they are on our website, so you have the ability to access. It's called the 2016 road management plan update. If you go to our website, all this data is in there and you can access it. Quickly, the next steps, we will be moving into phase 2, and I will be coming back to this group to tell you what we are doing in phase 2. Phase 2 really is the scoping of the EIS work, environmental review. When we have the input from the cities, we had me say that this is kind of like a puzzle. The city's plan will come to the county and we'll put it all together and see what the picture looks like. With that, we should be able to develop three alternatives and then take that to the public to see what level of environmental review do we have to do. It's likely that if there are no significant changes, we may rely on the 2007 EIS work that was done to the best that we can get away with. So, I don't have to go through this. Some of you are familiar with what we need to do in terms of preparing for the environmental impact statement. Again, I mentioned the previous 47 FEIS, which we may rely on. If we do three alternatives, then those three alternatives we have to go and have an open house from the public, seeking input. What level of analysis do we have to do, or does this three alternatives provide any significant adverse impact, environmental impact that will trigger us to do an EIS? So with that, we'll go into just this gives you a diagram of what is it that we need to do. When we have the final EIS, that's what we go to the hearing. Okay? So that in a nutshell is an update as to where we are, and feel free to continue to invite me to come back and give you an update as to where we are as we progress going forward. So I'll leave it for questions and answers.
So regarding the EIS portion of that, so in a nutshell, if no other environmental impacts are identified outside of the EIS done for the 2007
call. We'll
you can do a supplemental and yes. Reference the 2007.
Yes.
You go back to that process.
Yes.
Fast forwarding in the future here, probably 2016, how does the sub-area planning process get rolled into this spot plan update specifically?
I am planning on, I'm glad you bring that up, I'm planning on doing some internal work and some outreach like Salmon Creek and the Discovery Corridor, any proposed land use within those sub-areas are going to be forwarded in any of the alternatives.
What was that last part then?
Any proposed changes to those two sub-areas are going to be forwarded in one of the alternatives.
Okay.
As you know, alternative one is always status quo. No action. Two and three may be the same. Some might be the same.
Oliver, this document labeled Clark County Comprehensive Plan 2016 Update. Who offered this?
The board, this is my staff offered that, but that's what came out of
this is your staff's interpretation, and it's also labeled, it's subtitled BOCC Principles and Values.
Yes.
This is the staff's interpretation of the BOCC Principles and Values.
We discussed that in the board. There was a 2005 version of that.
Yeah.
Yes, this is the 2006 version.
This is and they've seen this and approved, adopted this?
They've reviewed it, and this is what we asked them to affirm what they've already approved in the work session.
Have they affirmed this?
No, they're going to affirm that. They've affirmed that in a public work session. We want them to affirm it in a hearing.
Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Oliver. We appreciate it. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Oliver.
Next on the agenda is revenue forecast and fee report update with Jeff. Thank you, Jeff.
Right of Martin Snell here, because if this program were a motorcycle, I would be in a sidecar. So I'm Jeff Swanson. I'm the Director of Economic Development with the county. I'm relatively new in my role here. I've been with the county for about 11 months. Started running the county's railroad program. Just recently took on economic development. So I have really two things that I want to accomplish. I want to give a brief summary of where we're at with the fee waiver program using data that I just received from Susan this morning. So you're getting the most fresh look at where we're at with the program. And then talk a little bit academically about how one might evaluate a program like this if one were to do assessment evaluation. So first, here's where we're at. We have, as of the end of May, 116 projects in the program. We haven't fully compiled all of the data from the applications received in May just yet, but as of the end of April, the applicants have reported a projected increase in employees of 718. Projected increase in annual sales of $159 million and some change. Projected increase in taxable retail sales of a little over $38 million. And fees waived, you see there, application fees, $702,000. Total TIF waived to date, almost $76,000. Expected TIF waived to be $4.1 million and some change, so almost $5 million in total fees waived is what we expect. So my role in this came about a couple months ago, which is what brings me here. I was asked by Commissioner Ledore to do some data collection and some business outreach. Contact applicants in the program to ask about their projects and learn about their business, find out the project status, and help the community development staff collect data. My success was somewhat limited. I got about one call back every seven or eight calls made, and I think that's due to incentives not necessarily being aligned in my favor. Marty's the one that's got the big stick. If you want your fees waived, then here's the information I need from you. Now, in terms of the data that was collected, there have been some changes in the application format since the policy was adopted in June. The current format is a three-pager that looks kind of like this. Was the latest revision was dated March 16th, and the page that we're trying to get is this second page. that asks if you're an existing business doing expansion or if you're a new business, number of permanent jobs, square footage increase, gross annual sales, and taxable gross annual sales, taxable retail sales. And we're trying to delineate, trying to get the incremental change there. So we had a bit of a task to go back and for applicants in the program prior to March 26 try to collect all of this information. We have, as of this morning, complete data for 64% of all the applicants. So these figures reflect completion of 64%. Now the reliability, we were relying on applicants for the data, and some of my comments might add a little color to this. So the feedback I got when I spoke to the applicants, there's a lot of uncertainty on their part about trying to estimate future financial results. Forecasting is, I'm an economist, and so something that was drilled into me from day one is forecasts are always wrong, right? There's a degree to which they're wrong, but they're never correct. So it's more witch doctoring than it is an art, was what my professors always taught me. So it's understandable that when you're asking somebody to fill out a form that they're going to submit to a government in exchange for fees waived, they get a little nervous about speculating on their future financial results and how many employees they expect to have. So we encourage them, telling them, well, we need you to complete the form. You need to fill in all the fields. So some of the responses were, well, I don't know if annual sales are going to be $1 or $1 million. So that was some of the responses that they actually put down. They expressed some uncertainty about what portion of business revenues would be taxable, subject to taxable retail sales. Some projects aren't proceeding. Some applicants were declined unresponsive, obviously. Some of the projects involve construction on spec or just doing preliminary site work. And so the applicants could only speculate about the nature of the ultimate tenant or the use on the site, and so they declined altogether to give an estimate. That's completely reasonable. Some of the projects clearly were outside the domain of taxable retail sales. A church, for example, isn't in the business of generating taxable retail sales. So, you know, the bottom line here is that the data collected from the applicants have this degree of speculation involved, and so there's some reliability that's lacking. And this kind of reliability, if you attempt to do any sort of analysis on that data, is just going to propagate throughout that analysis, right? So any sort of end result you try to hang your hat on when you analyze the data is subject to that sort of issue of reliability.
Does the county have any direct benefit or any taxable revenue at all from like higher paying manufacturing professional service jobs or just sales tax?
Well, let's get into that just a little bit, because I think as we talk about some ways you might evaluate a program like this, we can talk about that a little more holistically. All right. So when you go to evaluate a program, you look at policy goals and objectives. What do we expect to accomplish with a program or a policy? And then obviously you want to look at how will we know if our program did what we expected it to do? What kind of methods and metrics are we going to use to evaluate it? So this resolution, this is language out of the resolution, it provides for the collection of data. Says agreement will require, in addition to the other requirements of this ordinance, the amount of taxable retail sales generated by the business both one time and on an ongoing basis, and report on an annual calendar year basis. I added some emphasis there. And then the resolution also seems to mandate some kind of program monitor to monitor the effectiveness of the job creation program. Staff would report to the board every 6 months the number of job creation permits, the economic health, the unemployment status of Clark County, and the cost and revenue attributed to the projects that have received fee reductions or waivers. The county discretionary portion of sales tax reported by qualifying businesses shall be identified and used to repay a proportional share of all fees waived under this program. So this seems to sort of allude to a sort of cost-benefit sort of analysis. All right, so you can kind of get to this. All right, for every dollar waived, how quickly and on what basis will a return materialize? If you were to use some kind of cash flow discounting to calculate the timing of the return, you know, if you're doing a tighter grant application with federal DOT, they ask you to use a 3% and a 7% discount rate when you're calculating benefits from your project, when you're doing cost and benefit analysis. You would look at direct benefits, so you can look at retail sales tax as a direct benefit flowing from doing the project, incremental retail sales tax. You can look at property tax. What's the incremental local share as property tax, the increase in value on the property? There's the one-time local share retail sales taxes related to construction that might be generated. There are some indirect and more qualitative sorts of benefits. There's a multiplier effect related to construction. You have construction activity, then obviously the construction workers have more disposable income. They go eat lunch near where the construction project's going on, so you have these sort of multiplier effects going on. And obviously there's employment and personal income multipliers. So, you know, a couple of questions one might ask about the fee waiver program specifically is the fee waiver program significantly affecting the rate of change in Clark County's employment level? Is this above the background level change in employment? So there's some kind of background level change in the employment rate or unemployment rate, however you want to turn that on its head and look at it. So is what we're seeing in unincorporated Clark County relative to areas that say don't have a fee waiver program, is there some statistically significant difference in that rate of change? So this treatment control method, comparing and contrasting. Private sector uses methods like return on investment or return on capital employed. They have lots of different metrics you can use. And so you evaluate the change in revenues associated with the project. In the public sector, so it would be things like sales taxes, ongoing and one-time property taxes. You're looking for new revenue generated from doing the project. And so you're essentially what you're looking for is, does the increase in value, does the effect of doing the project, the cash flow generated, does the benefit outweigh the cost? And how soon do you hit the break-even point on a cash flow basis? There's an analogous method. If you look through the literature in public finance, one popular approach is this fiscal impact quotient. And I have some articles that John Payne and Mark Gassaway, Deputy Treasurer Mark Payne, or John Payne and Mark Gassaway, the County Finance Director, and benefit. Well, I would consider this market pretty saturated when it comes to burger joints. So all we're really doing is we're just spreading market share around. You're not actually seeing much of an increase there. Does that seem like a reasonable assumption? Now, if you look at NAICS codes and you're bringing in some business that's underrepresented in the market in terms of NAICS codes, then you might say we've seen some substantive increase in the market, right? Something that's underrepresented. So that's kind of the main point I'd say about this slide, except for we talk about retail sales activity, and Jamie and I were in a meeting earlier today. Think about what drives retail sales, and it's growth and personal income. So there's a wages, a nexus to the level of wages that goes on here too. So the wages that are associated with land use, retail land use, tend to be lower in the full spectrum of wages, right? So if we mixing ourselves down when it comes to the wage rates. So that would kind of lead one to assume that we're going to have less and less disposable income in sort of this aggregate sense of thinking. So we also need to think about how do we generate land that may not generate retail sales, but it's going to generate higher wage employment. So tech employment, industrial employment, and so on. All right, so here's a theoretical example. This I think you'll find amusing. We use discounted cash flow methods, and we just assume, okay, we're just going to evaluate a program, fee waiver program, on the basis of retail sales tax revenues alone. And this 4.8 some million figure might look familiar from an earlier slide. We got our discount rates of 3% and 7% respectively. And let's look at the incremental discretionary portion of local sales tax revenue, that 0.06%. We'll just assume that that flows in annually from the first year, so that resulting annual cash flow is $359,000. So in order to break even on that $4.9 million on a 3% discounting basis, we hit that in year 18 sometime. On a 7% basis, it's beyond year 25.
Where do you invest?
Well, so you would kind of ask yourself, and again, we're limiting ourselves to just retail sales. We could look at, we could throw some other benefit flows in here too. We could look at, all right, well, what's the property tax increment? And what about if we consider some other benefits of the program, increased employment and what wages are attached to that employment? So, yes.
A note on the property tax side is if we're talking about new development, from greenfield to new development, there's a substantial increase in property tax value and property tax revenue. If you're taking a building, a shell building, and you're doing tenant improvements, you're not moving the needle much. An example is we remodeled the permit center. We spent some amount of money on that, but that doesn't really move the needle to the value of this building. So the property tax increase, where you're going to see some bang for the buck, is on new development.
So if we went back here, maybe on the basis of that last slide we were looking at, we might say, okay, well, maybe we're being a little too narrow with our program. And from a policy standpoint, we need to broaden out what we would consider to be benefits. And maybe we need to broaden out what we would consider to be cost, too, because we could do the same exercise on a cost basis. Okay, so here we go. What are some things in this equation that we can change? What parameters can we adjust? Well, to make this payoff, this break-even point, a little closer in our future, we could cap the amount of fees waived, we could target the caps, we could set a cap on TIF waivers, because really that's where you see the bulk of the fees waived, is in the TIFs, right? You could target participation or eligibility, you could target it just to industrial use, or you could mix it industrial, small businesses, you could use a program that's targeted to emerging enterprise and based it on NAICS codes. So these are all some policy tools that you could use to create more of a targeted program that might change that return on investment equation, in addition to broadening out how you guide the program. And so,
thank you, Jeff. Anybody have any quick questions for Jeff before he has to cut out here?
Are you asking for feedback or just presentation information?
Some feedback would be great, but since I'm the sidecar on this little motorcycle rickshaw thing.
we could have a subsequent.
Well, just for 30 seconds.
Sure.
18 years, whether it's 18 years or 25 years, the payback's not there.
Yeah.
But you incentivize the behavior that you want. You target and select down and scope down the behavior that you want. Don't get rid of it. Figure out what you want to go after that.
Do we have statistics what happened when we had it for when it was the 10 employees?
Yeah.
How does that compare with?
Prior to June of 13, so we had the resolution with 15 jobs and 10. I think we had under 15 projects. Under 15 projects. Then the earliest and the first version of the program was in targeted areas.
Yeah.
And it was to commercial builds and tenant improvements. It was to building permits. It wasn't to site plan review and engineering and all that. So we could look at, I think for comparison's sake, we look at the resolution that was in place that required either 15 or 10 jobs. And look at how many projects and what were the fees weigh and so on and so forth, and then look at it against what we have today.
I think what Odd was pointing out, that's we had that discussion in the last presentation too, right? Is that the take some of the.
I'm thinking of a few of people. Forgive me for picking on a project.
We have a few of them.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
For what?
The two of them.
You want a car wash, right?
Well, yeah. $1 million for a fuel depot that's going to generate
two jobs.
I think there are
three fueling stations.
That makes no sense.
We're waiting between.
According to these men, it makes no sense.
On each.
Yes. But the program, I think itself, is fundamentally sound. Mm-hmm. It's the outliers that are just killing the return on.
These are the exact same items we brought up to the board when we testified and when we commented on them. Exactly. Mirrors it. We talked about the metric. They're just now getting to the metric. We talked about basis of jobs, wage, a certain wage, targeting certain sectors. We talked about all that. That's exactly what we brought up. And it looks like it's we were kind of...
Vancouver's gone the opposite way. You know, with the Banfield stuff, they're crafting an ordinance that really targets it, and it's only like half of the fees are being waived. That seems like a more effective...
Scope of employees.
Limits the scope when you say targets it, right?
Yeah.
The scope.
It limits the users that qualify based on the number of jobs, and then it only caps, you're only losing half the revenue.
It's based on a job program, some kind of job.
And I had a kind of a high level conversation with Commissioner Mandor on this sort of subject matter a couple months ago. And so his response was really what his goal was with this program was to send a message about Clark County's attitude towards business friendliness in general, and to try to show the community in the West Coast that we're open to business, that we're business friendly, and to use it as marketing. And it's like, well, okay, that's a policy position, and that's the board's prerogative to take that kind of policy position. But the ordinance language has some kind of evaluative sort of suggestion, right? So it's a little bit unclear to staff what our role is and what we're supposed to do with that. And I think probably to the community as well.
Can I suggest that?
Yeah.
Forgive me for getting out in the left field here. Pick the target that you want, and then figure out what the metrics need to be to hit that.
Sure.
That's one.
Work from the other end.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. We need to move on.
Thanks.
Jeff, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is going to be the concurrency ordinance updates. And Lori, if you want to come up to the table. While she's doing that, Rosie handed everybody an email that from me, from Chris Bramer, who did have a suggestion with the only comments I got from any traffic engineer that I sent out the draft concurrency code to. And the only item that he suggested, and this isn't anything that we necessarily need to do, have any action on today unless the board feels it necessary, is to have a section of the code that might allow the responsible official, planning director, or whomever, the ability to not necessarily follow the letter of the law with regards to the concurrency ordinance if empirical evidence, and I'm paraphrasing what Chris is saying here, but if empirical evidence shows that a certain corridor is at a 0.9, other evidence, whether it be staff or additional study or whatever, shows it to be different, and can affect any mitigation or whatever might need to take place, that the responsible official might be able to somehow not necessarily follow the letter of the law. It's akin to, hey, we're trying to get a one-size-fits-all. It's a simplified code, and we understand that. But again, we all know with one-size-fits-all codes that there has to be some flexibility, at least on a higher level, for things that fall outside of the mold. So that's essentially what this email states in a nutshell. So I'll let Lori take it from here.
I'm just here to
state
where we're at, the status of the project. As you may recall, we gave a presentation on the first. You all had copies of the proposed changes to the ordinance for the CFP. The email that Mike is referencing is really the only comment we received on our proposal, and we received it today. So not a lot of time for us all to review, and I think we can talk about just our initial responses to it. Yes, we wanted a simplified approach to concurrency as opposed to what we do now where we have a model and we calibrate it all the time. And we wanted something that was simple for everyone, both the applicants and the staff. That's why we put the proposal forward. Had a discussion with on the way to the meeting, and they pointed out there's a study that, and this was a discussion we had before the meeting, that you have a special study and it can go maybe a way that you don't expect. If you're looking at a rural road with ditches, that maybe that capacity is lower, which may not be what the applicant would want. So those are my comments. Just real quick, as far as process, we've got a work session with Planning Commission tonight. I am going to report that you all unanimously voted May 1st to support our proposal. And then we have a hearing on July 17th before the Planning Commission. And then it goes to a board hearing in August.
I was just going to follow up on what we were talking about, Chris Bramer's email. And historically, we've all encountered situations where we wish we had flexibility in the code, and sometimes when we wish we didn't have flexibility in the code. If there's flexibility, allow staff to get there when it's really legitimate. But also, if there's flexibility, allows anyone to come in and say, we're a special case, we're different, we really wanted to custom negotiate this deal. And I'd say for every 10 times where we've wanted the flexibility, because it's the right thing to do, for every one of those, there's maybe 10 where it was a force that really wasn't justified. And we got involved with attorneys and the developers were really pushing too hard. So I guess, at least my perception is the net for us is better to not have the flexibility in the code. So we're not left with folks coming in right and left wanting to custom negotiate their stuff.
Sure. And Chris indicates in his email that if this is something that staff doesn't want to pursue, he's not going to pursue it. It's one of those items where essentially, I think what he's saying, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he's saying, hey, something to consider, but if you guys feel it not necessary or that the alternative is something worse than what we would have presently, then hey, I'll just back off and not worry about it. again, it was more informational. I got it on Tuesday. I didn't have a chance to even send it out, review it with him, and get his permission to send it out till today, or till today. So my apologies for a little delay there, but David?
I appreciate the David Jardine, concurrency engineer. I appreciate the email. The feedback is good. Chris is a great guy to work with, and he's got a lot of great things to offer. I do think that that the county does offer some flexibility. There is a little bit of language in the concurrency ordinance already that allows the public works director or delegated staff to respond to a request from a traffic engineer that has enough evidence to support a position. They submit that to staff, me, and I'll review it, see if I can validate it, put it in front of senior management, and see if maybe we can move forward, put it in front of the public works director, and see if maybe we can move forward on it. So from that aspect, I think there's a little bit of flexibility. It gives staff the opportunity to kind of review kind of preliminary estimates of what the traffic engineer is coming up with without the traffic engineer really getting into the nitty-gritty of everything. But identifying, hey, well, I may not have enough or a lot of trips going this direction. Can we modify the scope of the study? Can we knock off a couple of intersections? Can we, you know, can we retake a look at maybe this rural geometry segment in an urban area? And right now, the way you guys have your concurrency ordinance set up to measure segment B over C ratios, we're way over. But if you look at that rural section of road, we have 2 foot shoulders, we have extra wide lanes, we, you know, we have some clear area. You know, if that all plays into the capacity of the roadway. So, you know, maybe we can be flexible that way. When we can validate the information, when we, when, you know, the traffic engineer approaches the county in written form so that we can respond in written form, and it gives the public works director the opportunity to kind of make a decision one way or another. So it does happen to be a case-by-case basis, but it's not everybody that has kind of that monetary backing to move that direction in doing those additional pretty extensive studies.
I just want to add from a process standpoint that, as I mentioned, we have planning session and work session pretty much after this meeting. What we're presenting to them is, since I didn't really get any feedback until today, I'm presenting to them what I presented to you all on May 1st.
Sure, and I think that I think the board would agree that that's fine. That we've already gone over the merits of the new ordinance, and we all agree that it was unanimous, I believe, that the ordinance is far superior to what we have presently, and simplified the reduction in the CFP as well as the potential for reduction in TIP. So, yeah, I think that's just great.
But it wouldn't be wrong to share this email with the Planning Commission. I mean, just because staff hasn't had a chance to really noodle it, having been on my wing for 18 years, they can do what we're doing and analyze it and listen to what you're going to have to respond with. So I think it wouldn't be right to not share this email with them.
Yeah,
have you consulted a mental health professional? 18 years on planning.
I just wanted to. I would want to see this.
Marty, that is on the record, by the way.
That's fine. I mentioned that, and you know this, that the proposal they're going to see is tonight, and that if we want to go back and change this, that affects the timeline. That affects. We would have to go back to a work session with the changes to the Planning Commission before we go to a hearing.
And we just need to see that. See it.
Not. Yeah, and maybe with David's explanation. David, are you going to be, with his explanation, that might, you know, allay or at least modify. Have them feel that they're, you know, this is already been addressed in the current focus. Yeah, and I think we would appreciate it. Hey, from the expert on the Planning Commission side, yeah.
Planning Commission can change code on the fly, that's why it's good for them to see it. That's all.
And especially if it's something, be it late or not, from a well-respected industry professional. Is that all you had? Great. Thank you.
Lori, thank you.
Where's my agenda? There it is. Final sites and final plat updates, questions and answers. For Diana and...
And Chuck.
That was good. We had 20 minutes.
Actually now. Made it.
Yeah. Yeah. We might get there.
Everybody wants to get out of here because it's so hot.
Yeah,
what's up with that?
All right, well, good afternoon, Lori, for having us back to discuss this. What I'd like to do first is just kind of like the final plat process, what we've learned, where we're at. We ran through our models with one of them that has gone to recording, the information I'd given you guys a while back actually proved very successful and beneficial to the applicants. In working with Jane on it, she liked what we were sending her direction with those. When we got them back, staff could clearly see what was in the packets. It's really consolidated how they submit things, so they're not just submitting one-offs, which really add to a lot of the time. So what we found is, both for staff and the applicant, it's cut down the time that's spent chasing things down, figuring out what do we have, what do we still need. It's always concise in whatever they're giving back to us, whatever we're giving back to them. So we've had some success with that. Moving forward, we're starting to implement it with all of them. We've been doing some staff training to make sure staff understand the use of this out each time. It always goes out. It's part of their cover sheet, essentially, of what we expect and what we need. On the final site plan, we were talking about this coordinate because it's a unique situation right now. All of the things that would have fallen under our final site plan so far that we could have tried some different techniques with have all fallen under a 60-day review process, which is a process we're looking at trying to make a little bit more simplified for our customers anyhow. So it's been unique because we've not had a standalone final site plan to try and do the same type of thing with that we've done with the final land division.
So let me get this straight. Yeah. All the final site plans that you've had come through lately have all been under the 60-day process? So,
yes.
Interesting.
Yes, actually our esteemed leadership team, just to get that on record, have been approving the to make it easier by you guys as the applicants and allow those processes
so
to move forward.
So what qualifies an application for the 60-day review?
Generally,
what would disqualify?
Anything that would fall under a normal site plan review usually can be requested to be considered for a 60-day, but that request is made by the applicant to the community development director, that'd be Marty Snell. He coordinates with development engineering's manager and director to make sure that they have the capacity within their workloads. From there, once he says yes, the applicant starts working very closely with the planner that's going to be assigned to it, and any issues are all dealt with before the application's ever made to the county.
I just want to know what criteria is used to determine whether you accept an application and review it under the 60-day period, or you disqualify it. Is it staff time?
First question should be, how can you disqualify?
I don't know anyone that's been disqualified.
I don't think so.
There have been some projects that have come through, like Highway 99,
yes,
where I say, you know, if I say yes to a 60-day, we might blow it by a week, we might blow it by 10 days, because of some of the design challenges.
Right.
So, sure, we can take it into a concurrent review, let's call it that.
Okay.
Instead.
Mm-hmm. Is it complexity of the project?
It can be. It can be. Like one project, Highway 99, the State Burger property, they've also got a right-of-way vacation, they've got, I think, a separate piece north, and so, hey, we'll do our best. And I was talking to Mike. That's what we were heading down about concurrent review. Engineering and site plan review together. That's what this really is. We just called it 60-day review. And most of the site plans have been coming through with a request of 60-day. Now it's about the capacity that we have in engineering and environmental and in land use review. And we've held our own there. Now, what's important to note is if you have a transportation issue or, you know, a critical area, we want those issues identified and kind of worked out earlier on. So once we get your application and it's fully complete, that at the 30-day early issues meeting, which we have,
we don't identify, oh, this is going to blow a schedule by 30 days.
And so by identify, like if you're going to do need a habitat permit because you're impacting buffer, you have to have that.
You should get that in and get it going.
So where's the assumption on the engineering plan percentage for the process for the 60 day? Is that going in and submitting? Is that at what point do you need final engineering plans?
Right at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Right
out of the gate.
Right at the very beginning.
And while in the past it's more of a feasibility process, you get your staff report, make sure that everything's cool with your site plan, then you proceed with final engineering. Here, there's a risk. There's a risk to the applicant, and the consultants for that, the applicant, need to know their stuff and make sure that everything meets code out of the gate. The project introduction meeting is a good time for all staff to look at that, to review what the issues are going to be, particularly from a traffic standpoint, from a transportation standpoint. And then at least gives the planner the eyes on the site plan and say, hey, you have met this, and this. I would think that those site plans that have been reviewed on the 60-day, it's pretty close to meeting code right out of the gate, which is a testament to the consultants knowing their stuff.
And it's part of the partnership too.
Yes.
Because as soon as Marty approves it, he's moves me to approval within 24 hours. We have the banner signed, and there's a touch point within probably 72 hours of that to start talking about all the issues. What are your concerns as a consultant? What are our concerns based on what we know about the property from the county side? And you start having those conversations constantly.
Yep.
David? Very close.
That was the guy that did Steakburger, 60-day plan. It's actually my very first development engineering project, and I got tossed into a 60-day. So, at any rate, I just, the 60-day process, and I just wanted to kind of quickly go over that. The final engineering plans, they are, like, right up front. So when we have the meeting that Mike was talking about, that pre 60-day meeting to kind of introduce your project, lay it out on the table so that staff can see it, we can comment on it. It's kind of like a pre-app. We're going to identify the critical issues, the critical areas, whether or not you need a road mod, all of those types of things. And then you can decide from there how best to lay out your timeline so that you can maybe submit a conceptual road mod to put before the road mod committee to kind of get a feel for which way they may need information to come in. It's not necessarily that they'll approve the road mod, but they'll take a look at it and give the thumbs up, submit it formally. That takes care of the road mod. The habitat stuff and the environmental, that's big time also. But as soon as you submit your application, it's deemed fully complete, we get a schedule. As soon as that schedule comes out, there are very specific milestones on that sheet that staff has to meet. And basically what happens is, so you submit your, speaking for development engineering, you submit your final engineering plans. Day one, man, we're reviewing those construction plans because we have 21 days to get those done. So that schedule reflects that. So basically what ends up happening is we start, the role reversal happens in that we start pushing the developer, hey, get your stuff in, yep. We got to meet these timelines if you want to go in 60 days, that kind of thing. So it is, it's a great process, concurrent, ultimately what we want to do is we want to be able to write the staff report so that we have maybe minimal conditions or conditions that need to be met prior to occupancy, rather than right up front you need to take care of these easements and all that kind of stuff. So it's a great process, but everybody seems to want to do that. And it I've got three more projects that are coming in for a 60-day review that are kind of on the difficult side regarding access and transportation kind of stuff. But I think it. When we take a look at the Steakburger site, the MAJ place is what they're calling it. I think that's a great poster child to to kind of mimic there.
because they did a lot of upfront work and really worked the staff to get that going on.
So then, which leads me to the questions that I originally brought up with regards to the final site plan process and things that are required before final site plan that are could be pushed off to construction approval. How's that going?
Well, since we have one that comes in, I mean, we can do those documents.
Oh, that's right.
As long as it's written in the staff report we can do it that way. And technically, we should have our documents and reported easements, our right-of-way dedications. All that should be done prior to the structural approval because we have to accept those roads and we want everything in place.
Right. So then the question becomes, is staff working to change when those things are required? It's as simple as taking your easements need to be done before final site plan and moving them down in Word down to prior to occupancy.
Correct. No, absolutely. If unfortunately I think in some of our software we have standard conditions and then we have those specific to the project, and it's a matter of when we have this, we have the ability, usually myself along with Diana, get a chance to review the staff report before it goes out. So it's up to me to make sure that we're starting to shift those where they should be based on meeting that need.
So right now then, the final site plans that you're reviewing, it's conditioned that way. It's conditioned that all of this stuff needs to be done before final site plan approval. You can't change that because that's what sacrosanct, and it is in there, and the only way that you can change the where this particular item is required is by going through a post-decision review and getting it changed?
Actually, for development engineering, I just had this happen because Stateburger, they had some easement issues. Okay, so what happened there was looking for a place to put the condition that wasn't right up front.
Right.
The condition ended up to be a provisional condition. Before we accept the final construction, the easement has to be in place.
Exactly. We want to write the easement to where the utility is, not write the easement and then put the utility in.
Correct.
Okay.
And just to address what you were asking, though.
Yeah.
I don't think, and I know that there's been some times where we move conditions around without actually going through a post-decision review.
Okay.
I think it depends on the, not severity, but the condition itself,
okay.
How significant it is, really determines, do we need to do this, or is it administratively, you know what, you're right, this would make better sense to be done here rather than here. So, and it's just figuring that out, but if we can make it more streamlined from the get-go, I'm all for that.
Well, I know from my... From my standpoint, what I'm going to be doing in all my applications from now on is I'm going to be specifically requesting in the narrative that the request for easements and covenants and everything else be done prior to provisional acceptance so that you guys know that I want it here and not take a boilerplate staff report and accidentally have it up because I don't think, do you issue draft staff reports during through the 60-day review? I can't remember if you do or not.
No.
You don't? Okay, so therefore... We have to be up front as a consultant and say, hey, this is where we want this. We don't want it to come out and say, you put it in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Okay, so, because that was my main concern with the final site plan process is that all of a sudden we're doing these things, you know, it's the cart before the horse issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Good. Is that it? Anything else?
Okay. Real quick on the final plat, Eric's. I guess, Eric, there's a subcommittee with that's been working with you guys or something or looking at. So, no.
Okay, it was. I think there was an intent for one, but
okay.
Never.
Anyway, I volunteered because I know Eric, and that won't surprise you that I volunteered as one of my interests. So, we're going to send out some emails and try to regroup and just get together and look at the details. And you know, you and I talked at one point about looking at the jurisdiction, looking at the process itself, and that kind of stuff. So, just wanted to mention that. So.
Yeah.
Perfect. And thank you for your help on that, Paula.
Any other questions for Chuck Diana?
Just to follow up to your comment, you mentioned covenants and easements. There's probably a checklist of things, and if you really went through it, there'd be additional items that could change location in the single process.
Absolutely.
Would,
how do we get through that checklist? What would be the process to take the next step? Covenants and easements are the obvious one.
Right.
What else could we suggest?
Actually, to tell you the truth, I took this is I'm a big advocate of different jurisdictions stealing shamelessly from other jurisdictions, the best things that they do. As such, I have taken a spreadsheet that the City of Vancouver has for their final acceptance of construction and sent it to Diana to be used as a kind of a template for what these items would be, whether it be from the engineering standpoint, approval of sanitary connection, water connection, easements, covenants, all of those. It's a fairly comprehensive list, and it's the master list that was provided to me. They were happy to share it. And I think that that's where we start with that. So if I'd pass it on to you, Ott, if you're interested in it. But I think that with that, we have pretty much all that we need. Maybe it's just that we need to share it with everyone to see what it is that might be specific, project specific.
I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
And just from my personal experience, just one-off experience, the project that I've had and the issues that I've met that we're talking about right now have been hugely frustrating and very expensive. And there are cost-free things we can do to incentivize development in this county. It has nothing to do with impact fee deferrals or waivers or any of that. It comes down to time. And when a project, an engineering review is held up for 30 days for a covenant, that's asinine. It's counterproductive and it costs almost nothing. That's the low-hanging fruit, and we should be all over that stuff.
I've recently been through something exactly that way, and it didn't have anything to do with development review, public works, or anything that happened with the PA's office. And I don't think they fall under anybody's purview except the board.
Yeah, it's not you guys. It's not at this level. It's just the way it's been done.
It was for Mr. Bullock.
I got to go to Marty to get it. I do my best to try
to get something happened. And we appreciate that.
Yeah, you're very proactive in that.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that the bandwidth in the civil division of the PA's office is very, very challenged. Comparatively speaking, we have a very small civil division. And Chris Horn, for the most part, does a lot of this work. He's got, other than Chris Cook, who's got maybe, 5 or 6 years under her belt, Chris Horn has 4 or 5 brand new attorneys. And they all kind of specialize in different areas of the law. One's more on the employment side, on public records requests, those kind of things. So,
and we recognize
Chris,
that.
Chris, you know, I try to get him to review things as timely as possible, but when he has the time, he doesn't. But he also gets pulled by the hallway down the way to work on other things. So it's something I keep talking to him about.
Thank you for your efforts.
Yeah, we do. It makes a difference.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, if that was it, thank you. If there's no other comments.
Rosie has a question.
Oh, okay. We weren't done. We weren't done here yet. It's your parking pass. Any public comment? Before we go, though, before we adjourn, I just wanted to say thank you to the people that did attend the annual review yesterday.
Very well.
Whether you commented or not, just having us there as a presence and as a group, I think was very important. And, you know, it went real well. I think it was well received. And we'll just see how it goes for next year. So,
very, very quickly, our agenda is light for July. Thank you, Jamie, for bringing forward at least the one item, impact fee delays. Do we want to keep it light? If not, is there any topic areas that anybody comes to mind that we want to pursue? Or
seeing as that we were over time right now, let me take a look at this, and I'll send out an email within the next week to the board to see if there's anything on our work plan that we just presented to the board that we might want to address or have staff address.
That sounds excellent. And we are a week later than normal. We did move to July 10th.